This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
So, Trooper, you're not too worried about fighting the arachnids?
Hey, shoot a nuke down a bug hole, you got a lot of dead bugs.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. Today, we're going through the second part of two episodes on the bugs from 1997 Starship Troopers. As always, the show's broken up into a few different segments. There's time codes below so that you can skip ahead to the bits you're looking for. Last week, we went through a quick summary of the movie, what we thought of it, if it's any good or not. And Dave took us through the physiology of the bugs. So go back and listen to that if you're interested. Today we are going through the history of giant bugs in movies and the ecology of these bugs. But before we get into that, my name's Sam Perrin. I am an ecologist at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, currently writing my PhD. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses, along fellow ecologist and co-host number one Adam Harsick, who's writing his PhD at the University of Arkansas. We are your movie ecologists, and as always, we're joined by... Well, not really as always. It varies. But we are joined this week by co-host number two, Dave, who is a Canadian vet and a movie physiologist.
Allegedly.
Look, we've been through this. I was there for the ceremony. It was lovely. So, the world's on fire.
The world is very much on fire, literally and figuratively.
It was 42 degrees in Perth the other day in November.
Ugh. Jesus.
We're probably in December when this comes out, but yeah, it reached 42 in Perth. Bushfires have spread across six times the area that they were in Brazil throughout eastern Australia.
Jesus.
Thankfully, not many people have died.
Which is incredible.
It is incredible, yeah. So, and I don't know if you guys have heard this, but two people died in the bushfires, which of course is a tragedy, but it's a very small loss of life, human life, I should say, considering the size of the fires. This motherfucker Barnaby Joyce, who many of you might know from Johnny Depp's poodle incident.
Yep.
Yep.
Came out and said that the two people who died were probably Greens voters, and it's that party's policies that are contributing these fires. Yeah, he did. Yeah. And this follows a massive pattern of inaction in a lot of countries in the world. I mean, I don't know if you guys... Adam, on Twitter, are you getting a bunch of ads from the Brazilian government talking about this new sustainable Brazil?
No, I haven't.
They're popping up on my screen all the time. And maybe because on Ecology for the Masses, I posted a piece about 2 months ago on why we stopped caring about the Amazon, which is still burning, by the way.
Yep.
But ever since then, I keep getting ads on Twitter about the new Brazil and the new face of Brazil, the environmentally friendly place, which is bullshit. They're not doing anything about this sort of thing.
It's still the locals that are doing the most to actually fight these fires.
Yeah.
It's the same thing that's happening in the US and in Australia, where you have these very conservative, they tend to be conservative, but like, science deniers that are doing everything they can to fuck everything up and then act like it's not a problem because they won't have to deal with it.
So in Australia, I think the local management policies are generally pretty good. The ecology is adapted there to for a history of, you know, periodic wildfires. Every 5-10 years, you have a big blaze, rejuvenates life. Problem in Australia is that the weather's just getting so hot because climate change is acting really fast there. It's a problem now for the ecosystems because whilst they're used to a big blaze every 5, every 10 years, even every 2 is fine, it's just happening every year now. I mean, Australia had wildfires in the tropics last year. And so you guys were mentioning that the koala now, they think, is almost functionally extinct.
It is functionally extinct.
It is functionally extinct.
So we've talked about functional extinction before, whereby the population's so low that it just won't be able to recover itself. And it's now a definite that it's going to go extinct.
Yeah, that's the idea that's just like we've destroyed their food source. Oh, you know, we can support them and we can bring them back in and we can do natural like breeding programs, but like you're not going to do anything for the wild ones that are out there that just can't find food.
No. And the population you have whenever you like keep them in captive breeding is going to be a very, very, very small subset of the natural population. And when you do that, you have what's called a genetic bottleneck, where you have the founder effect, where basically you have this entire population that has this normal amount of genetic variation, which is good and healthy, so they can respond to different threats depending on what happens. But then you take 10% of that, and you say, okay, this is the new population. Whatever genetics that 10% has is what every other koala from now on is going to have.
Yeah.
And so that creates a bottleneck in the population. That's why cheetahs are going slowly extinct, because there was a huge bottleneck for them at the end of the Ice Age. That's why German Shepherds, at least in the U.S., all have hip problems, because they've been bred to such a small gene pool that now that every single one of them has terrible hips.
European bison. So the entire European bison population comes from about 3 males.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's crazy. They had problems with when they were reintroducing the wolf to Sweden in, I think, the 80s or 90s. It was just a product of one mating pair that came in. Then you had one more wolf come in, which meant that there was enough genetic diversity to get a population, but it's still heavily inbred.
Right.
And it's weird because, like, there are certain areas in Australia where koalas are just, like, you introduce them to an area and they flourish. They actually get overpopulated and then they start to have these really severe effects because there's too many of them. And so in that situation, you can either relocate, which is an incredibly, like, relocating a species is not easy. It's not a matter of just, like, strapping it into the front seat and, you know, letting it hop out on the roadside somewhere.
Kind of cute to think about.
But you can relocate or you can cull. And now culling might sound horrible, but it really helps the local population actually stay stable. But we can't do that in Australia. You can't cull a species as cute as the koala. We have enough problem doing it with kangaroos, and kangaroos are considered a pest by a lot of people.
Which is why Australia's Minister for Agriculture, Barnaby Joyce, was so angry.
It's time that Pistol and Boo buggered off back to the United States.
That's pretty ballsy. Elected officials very rarely risk openly telling puppies to go fuck themselves.
Now, like I said, we're looking at Starship Troopers today. So I thought what we'd do is go through the cinematic history of the giant bug. Now, the Melbourne Museum has a natural history section. And what they have there is just this massive montage of all the different bugs in films, the huge bugs. And it's kind of like an explanation running alongside all these clips of why bugs can't grow to large sizes. We've kind of gone through this before. Dave touched on it last week in the episode. One of the films that plays heavily in that video is Starship Troopers.
Nice.
Which is really weird because it's meant for kids. And so they've obviously cut out some of the more graphic details. Big bug films were actually a huge trend in Hollywood back in the 50s. It was a response to, fears about radiation. However, there's been some really interesting essays written about 50s horror films and that sort of stuff that have some very different takes on it. There's a quite famous essay by a woman called Margaret Tarrant, it's called Monsters from the Id, and it talks about, like, some of the psychology of these things. And I'm just going to read a passage that concerns some of these early horror films. So there are also some science fiction films which, while based on psychoanalytic concepts, concern themselves with a variation of this theme. A number of them deal with impotence and frigidity. This group includes films such as Spider-Woman, Roy William Neal, 1944, Wasp Woman, which was done by Roger Corman, who some of you may have heard of,
yep,
and The Fly, the original Fly, by Kurt Neumann in the 1958, which explore insect phobia, fear of castration, and dread of the phallic mother. Now, there's some phallic symbology in Starship Troopers.
Quite a bit.
It doesn't run that deep, but it's certainly there. Yeah, like the thought of impalement, which is actually a lot of what fed into the Alien movies.
Yeah.
The whole tube down the kind of throat thing. This is very much impalement through the head. And there's some other things that are read as well. So spiders as an animal horror subgenre are only generally beaten by dinosaurs and snakes. This was a subjective opinion, which I don't necessarily agree with. I think spiders as an animal horror subgenre are more effective than dinosaurs.
I think so, absolutely.
Because, I mean, lots of people have phobias of spiders. Like, they see something and they're like, that is an actual thing, just smaller. Whereas dinosaurs, I mean, there's an element of the fantastical there.
I think if you're going to have any random person from anywhere at least in North America, at least in the English speaking world, maybe if you're going to have a phobia of dinosaurs versus snakes versus spiders, it's going to be spiders every time.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. The snakes thing's kind of been popularized by Indiana Jones, but I mean,
yeah.
Anyway, we got a bit carried away there. But in the 50s, like I said, there was a big wave of big bug films. Maybe the most notorious from this period is Them. Which is these giant irradiated ants that go around destroying a town.
Yep.
There's the deadly mantis in 1957. Mantises actually crop up a fair bit. That might have something to do with the whole psychosexual women chopping man's head off.
And they look like aliens.
They do. They look very freaky. Well, this is a good point, perhaps, to point out what Dave first told me back in 2015. This whole thing about mantises actually chopping the heads off their spouses,
the female partners,
significant others. Yeah, the females beheading the males after sex. Dave, you said it's actually just a response to being watched, right? Like freaking out and lashing out at the closest thing?
Yeah, they've done a whole bunch of new research where they set up these hidden cameras to watch it, and it turns out most of the time the female doesn't actually eat the male after mating. That the primary reason that we've been seeing this is because you've got a human standing over top of you. It creates this like nervous fear response, and basically you get female mantises that are nervous eating. They're stress eating.
Yeah.
And they're stress eating the male mantis's head, which means that a whole bunch of male mantises got eaten after sex because humans wanted to watch.
Wow.
To be fair, it is still an extreme response. Like, I mean, if somebody walks in and you're having sex with someone, your first instinct is not decapitation.
It's not? No, it's not.
Yeah. Food, maybe, if you're a nervous eater. Like, yeah, I need a fucking snack now, but...
Got that pizza.
You know, you don't reach for the nearest... Yeah. Anyway, there was also The Fly, the original Fly movie, which was very much kind of body horror back in 1958.
Cronenberg.
And then there is a British entry to this list as well, the only really big bug British entry, which is The Strange World of Planet X, as it was called in Britain, or as it was called in America, Cosmic Monsters. And that involves some very weird, I think it was blood-sucking like ants or something like that, mutated ants.
Blood-sucking ants is awesome.
Of course, there's some Godzilla versions. There's Mothra, which, hang on, I'll see if I can find the paragraph. No, fuck it, I can't be bothered finding the original thing. Basically, nobody before had ever thought of like a moth as a threatening insect. You don't think of it as the action hero, do you?
No.
And I think that was proved by the most recent Godzilla film, because I thought that thing looked ridiculous. It looked beautiful, but in flight, I did not think for a second that it could take on a pterodactyl.
Absolutely not.
But there was actually another moth, which was in a film which in Britain was released under the title The Vampire Beast Craves Blood.
Okay.
Got all those old titles.
Yeah, in America, it was called The Blood Beast Terror.
Even better.
Oh, this you might have heard of a werewolf. You might have heard of a were-tiger or a were-leopard. Have you ever heard of a were-moth?
No, but I want one.
Okay, so in 19th century Britain, a series of grisly murders are taking place in the countryside near London. The victims are good-looking young men between the ages of 20 and 30. All have had their throats torn open and their blood drained. Explorer and naturalist Frederick Brightwell returns from Africa with some moth chrysalids for Dr. Malinger. And the handsome young adventurer soon becomes a victim of Claire, who is the real murderer. Claire is a were-moth and transforms at night to drink the blood of young men.
That's bonkers. I want to watch this.
That's pretty much it. So there's just a lot of real violent moth stuff.
Violent moth stuff is a sentence I never thought I'd hear in my life.
It ends with Claire Malinger, who is the daughter and the were-moth, her father attempting to create a male were-moth to be a mate for his increasingly bloodthirsty daughter.
All right.
Yeah. Look, it's from 1968, and I can't recommend it. But what I can recommend is called Mimic from 1997.
Oh, it's so good. I love Mimic.
I've never seen Mimic.
Look, again, I'll read out some of the plot from Wikipedia, because it sounds ridiculous. Okay, so in Manhattan, cockroaches are spreading the deadly Strickland's disease that is claiming hundreds of the city's children. Dr. Peter Mann, Deputy Director of the CDC, recruits entomologist Dr. Susan Tyler, who uses genetic engineering to create what she calls the Judas breed, a large insect that releases an enzyme which accelerates the roach's metabolism and causes them to starve to death faster than they can take in nourishment. Now, Judas breeds are actually a thing in ecology.
Yep.
It's where you find an animal that leads you to more of that animal so you can eliminate them. They use them in goats, camels. It's a really common pest control kind of thing. Carp as well in Australia. Anyway, it's successful. They get rid of the problem. And then 3 years later, a priest is chased and dragged underground by a strange assailant. Looking for more valuable specimens, there's a couple of kids who go down to the tracks, and these kids are violently murdered. Like, it's...
Wow.
It's really kind of... There's this one kid who just gets... I mean, you don't normally see that in films. It being a big exception recently. Kids do not get killed that often in film.
No.
But these are really murdered quite hard. Anyway, later on, Susan surmises that the Judas breed's accelerated metabolism has allowed them to reproduce at a similarly accelerated rate, and have managed to evolve over tens of thousands of generations within only 3 years, including developing the ability to mimic their human prey. So as she approaches a creature, it unfolds into an insect the size of a human being, which has adapted to appear human. It is some of the weirdest shit I've ever seen. Just go on YouTube.
It's really good. It's the movie itself, actually, the mimics are scary. Watching it as a kid, the movie did used to scare me.
That's awesome.
But it's crazy. And Josh Brolin's in this.
Is he?
Mira Sorvino is in Big Name 84. Charles S. Dutton, Giancarlo Giannini, Doug Jones without Doug Jones just as himself, without massive amounts of prosthetics on. Norman Reedus, old mate from The Walking Dead.
Oh, Norman Reedus, old Death Stranding himself.
Anyway, that's the only one I'll recommend of these. But look, they actually also featured in that awful run of like low budget, poor CGI horror films that we got maybe a decade ago. You know, the Sharktopus, Mega Shark versus Crocosaurus, and all that sort of shit.
Sharknado.
There was one at the end of that, which, look, I hate those movies because it's like, yeah, we get it. You're trying to be bad, but you are actually also just bad.
Yeah. It's not enjoyable. It's too aware of itself.
Yeah, you can't be Tommy Wiseau every time. It's not going to work.
No.
Anyway, but there was one called Big Ass Spider, which came out in 2013. That's the name, Big Ass Spider. Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Look, these things have actually appeared in genuinely good films, though. So, I mean, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, two big examples. Again, mainly big spiders. Shelob in the Return of the King. Fantastic scene. Genuinely scary. I was terrified when I was watching that as a 13, 14-year-old, whenever it came out. The second Harry Potter film, also quite terrifying. If you're an arachnophobe, I would not recommend watching that one. The Mist. There's some pretty cool bugs in there.
Yeah.
Which is a really haunting film. One of the better Stephen King adaptations. Speaking of which, there's a lot of spidery stuff in the second It film. And I also think that giant arthropods make up the best scene in King Kong, the 2005 version.
Peter Jackson, yeah. Hands down, poor Andy Serkis.
Oh, yeah, that thing is horrible. I don't know what they would be, but I don't think they're arthropods, but whatever they are horrifying. Some sort of giant annelid or nematode or something like that.
The gelatinous, yeah, thing with the teeth attached to it.
Real nasty, yeah. Horrifying creature, though. Oh, and also, I forgot to mention earlier, there is a giant praying mantis in the Godzilla universe as well, Kamakuras.
Cool.
Sometimes an insect will evolve to mimic its predator. A fly can look like a spider. A caterpillar can look like a snake. They are breeding.
Whatever it becomes, it destroys.
Peter, these are lungs.
Yesterday, it became human.
Yeah, so that's a brief history of giant bugs in cinema, which it was a lot of fun to do. Now, we're going to go through the ecology of the bugs. We've got to lay down some ground rules first. Adam and I have said that doing intelligent species isn't that fun, because if you have a species that's too intelligent, it's one of the reasons we've stayed away from the Predator. You can just say, and especially with the latest Predator film, that they're just doing genetic editing, whatever this is.
Yeah.
They can use technology to do that sort of thing. So we've approached these things as if they have quite limited intelligence.
As if they are true animals, not a sentient species.
However, I do want to point out that considering they say, you know, the bugs have launched something towards us, people in this universe have a really fucking hard time with the concept that these things are intelligent. They are clearly intelligent right from the get-go. And what is it that guy says? Frankly, I
find the concept of bug intelligence
offensive.
Yeah. I mean, they threw a fucking asteroid at heavy populated cities. Like, they were strategically... But the fact is, we're going to put that aside. We're also going to put a fact aside that they're giant. Because if we take that to account the fact that they can't be giant, it just kind of reduces the fun of this whole thing. But intelligence in any sense, before we get into the other stuff, I don't understand why a species like this would need to be that intelligent. I mean, they are killing machines already.
Yeah.
Like, what do they gain from growing larger brains?
That's a good point.
I also see that I have a very limited understanding of eusocial organisms, or organisms that live in colonies like ants and bees and termites, but they don't tend to be that intelligent on their own. They work very well as a superorganism, as a group of organisms working together, but...
Which makes way more sense to work as a superorganism.
Exactly. We are a cooperative species in the sense that we have like social structure and we work with one another, but we don't work as a singular organism altogether. And you really don't see intelligent species doing that.
No, and in fact, one of the main goals of boot camp for the military is to try and break down the individual mindset that affects your ability to command soldiers.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, humans evolved like a cooperative relationship as like a way to defend ourselves. We weren't going out attacking things. We had serious issues. We were a piss weak species before we, you know, got bigger brains. We were very much prey species. These things, I don't understand why they'd have any trouble bringing down prey at all. I mean, wolves hunt in packs because that's how they get food. They live in a place where the small foods... faster than them and
not enough,
yeah, and the big stuff is too big for one to take down,
so much bigger than them,
so it makes sense that they're larger. But I don't understand why these things would need to operate in like hunting packs, that sort of thing. Now I think potentially what they would be doing is, if they've evolved this sort of thing, is they're hunting much larger organisms.
They would have to be,
so yeah. And we'll get into this later, because I mean, They seem to give the impression that all these things are working together, all these different species of bug.
Right.
But, I mean, they're so completely different from each other.
Yeah.
So just to give you an idea of how separately related these things are, the scarab beetles, whatever they're called, the ones that...
Tankers.
The tankers, yeah. They look a lot like scarab beetles. Mm-hmm. Now, beetles are the order Coleoptera. The rest of them, I would say, are some sort of bug, which at the very least is a different order. Now, just to give you an idea of how separate orders are from each other, we are primates.
Yeah.
So the furthest thing away from us in the primate family is lemurs. And that's still closer to us than these bug species would be to each other.
Hmm.
So, I mean, there's no way that they can be... they can be communicating with each other across species.
No.
It is interesting.
You have, in nature, you have mutualisms between very markedly different species, but the way that it works, the way mutualism works in nature is not the way that we think about it in terms of like the way that humans do it. It's not that like, okay, I do this for you, you do this for me. It's just an interaction between species where both of them are paying a cost by working with the other, but that cost is far outweighed by the benefit they get from another thing. A good example of this is yucca plants, yucca flowers on trees, and the yucca moth, whereby the yucca moth has to lay its eggs inside of the flowers of these yucca moths, of these yucca flowers, sorry. And when these eggs hatch, they eat the seeds of the flowers. So the flowers are losing, you know, their offspring. The seeds are what they use to reproduce.
Yep.
But these moths also pollinate the flowers, so they're able to reproduce and get their genes out there more efficiently, and they pay a slight cost to their seeds being eaten. And the moths pay a cost in the sense that they have to do all this work pollinating, but they also get to lay their eggs. So, like, it's not like, okay, I do this for you, you do this for me. It's just that it works because both of them get more benefit than they pay
and a cost. And it's not something that crops up, you know, instantly. It's a behavior that's evolved over a long period of time.
Yeah. Millions of years.
So what I think's happened here is because it's mentioned, I don't know if it's mentioned in the movie that humans have nuked the surface.
They don't mention it, no.
No, they say that we've done orbital strikes before we land, but it's not covered in the same detail.
They say they glassed the surface.
Well, I think what you have left over here is just the creatures on the planet's surface that are overly aggressive to humans and capable of fighting off humans. I think all the rest are just dead. I think we've gone in and just, you know, cleared away typical fucking colonial bullshit and gotten rid of all the native species. And we're still just at war with the ones who are capable of fighting back. I think that species like that one that fires off the spores into space, which we can get into later, and the one with the flamethrower for the mouth. I think they are defensive mechanisms that they've adapted against these smaller things that hunt in like massive kind of colonies to bring down larger
prey. Okay. Cool.
I was thinking the same thing. Yeah, it would have to be some kind of response whereby these are normally fighting with one another, but maybe there's some kind of sensory mechanism in their brain that sees different as an enemy, and okay. The humans are so different that it's overriding their response against the other insects on the planet. Insects, quote, and yeah.
Yeah, I think they're just insanely territorial here.
Which makes sense, because they're so aggressive.
Yeah, and so I think that normally a lot of these smaller bugs would be teaming up to bring down those larger bugs.
Yep.
Kind of halfway between, like, cheetahs or wolves taking down larger prey, and when, like, a bunch of ants swarm a crab or something.
Right.
Yeah, and so I think that, the flamethrowing is just, like, a defense mechanism that's evolved against these smaller bugs, which has just happened to, be really effective against humans as well.
I also want to say that for the flamethrower, I really appreciate that it's like a true like napalm type like liquid fire. It's not that they're just doing flames. There seems to be some kind of semi-solid or liquid material in there that clings to you and then melts you as well. That's a really cool effect.
Yeah, and if you want to hear more about that, you should definitely go back and check out our dragon episodes from season 2. Because Dave goes into a lot. What makes a chemical a lot more likely?
Mm-hmm.
If you want Toothless's abilities ruined for you, that's a good episode for you.
Absolutely.
Hey.
So I think what we've just got are the species that are overly aggressive to humans left over. I think they would die out in time because the humans seem to have wiped out the rest of their prey species. And so I think that if you just left the bugs by themselves for a while, they'd eventually turn on each other. Yeah. I don't know if they're working as a super organism like that, if they get aggressive enough to attack each other. Because you don't generally see ants work against each other unless one of them's diseased or something.
Within a hive, you don't.
Yeah.
No, but they will eat each other if they start to starve.
They will, okay.
So I found this interesting example. So they had this Russian bunker. A lot of Russian bunkers got closed down after the Cold War.
Allegedly.
And they had this open vent that was allowing ants to fall through from a local colony. And researchers ended up going into this bunker and finding that it was completely sealed otherwise. The ants had no way of climbing out the walls and getting out. But they did have a working colony that survived for like 30 years inside of this bunker. And they did it by just eating other dead ants that were falling through into this area.
Okay.
Eventually, the super sweet, as the scientists left, they actually put a board in place that allowed the ants to like climb back out through the vent. And the ants do appear to have like left since then. But they were able to survive for a prolonged period of time by eating themselves, but it's not a normal feature.
Interesting.
So I think some of that would happen if the humans had just, left the area alone for a while, because they seem to have taken it, unless there's like, massive things underground, which is quite possible. Yeah. So,
I mean, something had to make those tunnels, and it could be very much they have some kind of earthworm analog on that planet as well. It's enormous. They're just able to feed on as well.
Now, the evolution of certain features here is really weird as well, so...
Yeah.
What's the advantage of being able to fucking shoot a missile 200, meters in... I mean, if it's dispersal, if they're doing that via planets, I guess that makes sense, but it's not realistic.
No, and why wouldn't they try something on Earth? If they can fire their spores that far, why send an asteroid towards Earth and not try to send your spores there?
I mean, I think that takes a certain level of intelligence and planning to think that we can set up a base camp or shoot like our troops into another area, and which is a weird thing because they're smart enough to fire an asteroid from their side of the galaxy on a planet that's rotating in a solar system that is rotating in their entire galaxy. To the Earth, which is rotating itself in a solar system, revolving in a solar system. So it's an incredible amount of complexity that's going on there.
Right. It would have made more sense if they were just firing out spores into space and some of them were just drifting and hitting different planets after thousands of years, or longer.
But again, the concept of them being able to spread between planets, it just makes no sense. Being able to fire something over a long distance... If you are a fairly sedentary species, I guess that kind of would help. They're larger species, so they would have a larger dispersal range anyway. One area would not be able to take that many of you because they presumably need so much fuel to keep them going, these large bugs. So I guess being able to disperse that way by being able to fire, you know, massive amounts of eggs across a large distance, like, you know, ten or 20 kilometers, would be an evolutionary advantage. Physiologically, I don't know how you'd do it, but maybe as a dispersal mechanism, it's fine.
I mean, for reproduction, it makes sense, because that's what almost every single arthropod that I can think of does. It is,
yeah.
They put out a shit ton of eggs or offspring of some kind. Most of them are going to die.
Right.
It's like something like 1 to 3% of them will survive to adulthood to reproduce.
And if you have a safe way of getting them your kids as far away from you as possible when you know that they're just going to grow up without, you know, the need for parental care, like most insects do, then you're fine. Yeah, I guess that's a good mechanism, I guess, yeah?
Yeah.
And the flamethrower on the face and all that sort of stuff, like I said, I think that's just defense against smaller predators. It is interesting, though, to see, you know, an insectoid alien race. Because, I mean, you look at how diverse insects are on, you know, on our planet. And I think there was a theory a while ago that it would be more likely that if there was alien life, it would be, an arthropod of some sort.
The warrior bug looks different than anything else we have on Earth. And I think I enjoyed that most about the film, was they didn't just create a giant ant. They tried to create something new and interesting looking.
Although, now's a good time to point up the fact that why would you have a species that is insectoid? They're insects and call them arachnids. That really pissed me off. For those, I mean, I assume that most people know this, but arachnids are what, you know, we refer to mostly spiders, but there's also ticks and mites in there. But they're not insects at all. They're a completely different class of animal. It's a different organism.
Right.
Yeah. And it'd be like coming across like a cat, a species that looks like a cat, and calling it a starling or something like that.
Calling it a dog.
Not even calling it a dog, calling it like a bird. Anyway. That I thought was very stupid. A couple more interesting things, though. So there is, it has been shown that within social castes of a single species, you can actually have different nervous systems, so different levels of intelligence within a species.
Right.
So, you know, having like a brain bug, even though that thing looks like a larva. That looks like the larval stage of an insect. That does not look like any fully grown insect ever. Like, it looks like a caterpillar or, you know, some sort of leech. Yeah, but, I mean, the hive mind is kind of interesting, but the thing commanding your hive would not look like that.
Yeah, I think in a hive mind goes what Dave was saying last week, is it's not really a true hive mind in a science fiction point of view of there's a central intelligence that is psychically controlling everything. It's just that they all follow a certain set of quote-unquote simple rules that means that they act as one organism, but it's not that there's one central organism controlling everything.
Right, they adapt, they change over time, there's limited form of memory, and I'm not against the idea of there being a larger, like, queen or some, like, coordinating organism for the colony.
Yes, queen.
You don't get psychic connection.
I didn't understand the point of that in the movie, anyway, the whole psychics thing.
It is, the brain bug is in the book.
No, but I mean, I don't understand the point of the whole, you know, psychics in the film.
Oh, just for fun.
It's just, it doesn't, I don't think it makes sense within the context of the film. It doesn't make sense. Like,
because you get to control ferrets.
I think that was also one of the dumbest scenes in the movie, where you have this brain bug that is dragged out into the open in an environment that it's not familiar with. It's intelligent enough to know that it's being threatened. It is surrounded by soldiers with weapons. Neil Patrick Harris's dumbass walks up and puts his hand on it for like a minute. Then he's like, it's afraid. And they're like, yeah. Like, no shit, it's afraid, dude. You don't need to be psychic to figure that out.
Anyway, yeah, Adam, anything you want to add?
One thing, another little fun little anecdote of watching beforehand. I think Sam was one of the only ones, at least I wasn't doing this before, like watching these movies with my partner to kind of go through it and get a different perspective. But she brought up the point of the scarab type beetles are blasting this plasma into space to hit the spaceships. It's like, how are they aiming these? Like, how can they see these spaceships from the planet? And while that is a really good point that I never thought of, a fun thing that some scientists at the university that I used to go to in Sweden figured out was that scarab beetles, so kind of similar to these organisms in general, they use the Milky Way to navigate at night when they're rolling their dung through the landscape. So it could be the thing where maybe these are also using the stars as some kind of navigation or signal, and they see these ships either that are different stars that are not like what they're supposed to be seeing, or they may be blocking out the stars that they normally would see. And so they know that that's where there's something different that they feel is threatening them, and they blast it.
Mm. Yeah. Cool idea. Yeah.
Take the example of the arachnids, a highly evolved insect society.
By human standards, they are relatively stupid. But their evolution stretches over millions of years. And now they can colonize planets by hurling their spore into space.
Okay, look, that's the ecology taken care of. Adam, you got a versus for us?
I do. We're talking about kind of a fun little... We think evolutionarily maybe these have adapted to work in groups against larger organisms. And then Sam is also shitting on this movie and comparing, and we're also comparing it to the better movies like Lord of the Rings. So I'm thinking, how would a handful of these warrior drones do against Shelob?
Oh.
Really well.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know. Where is it, though? Is it like a cave system? Has Shelob had time to web the place up?
It would, yeah, it would absolutely be in a cave system because Shelob hates the light. She would not be out in the open.
But has she had time to, you know, set a few traps and that stuff?
I don't know. I would think that this would be, yeah, okay, scenario is we have Middle Earth. We have Kirith Ungol, the tunnel that she lives in.
Mm-hmm.
And the spores have been shot to Middle Earth and you have a little colony of warrior bugs established. And so they're looking for food. They go into her caves.
If she's got the home ground advantage like that, but then again, like those things are sharp. Like
it's just even with the webbing, with her trying to get these, my biggest concern is just you can't beat numbers.
It would depend on how many of them there are.
Yeah.
Well, I remember listening to this great discussion from Jackie Chan a couple of years ago. This like amazing martial artist, and he was like,
"We know who fucking Jackie Chan is, you twat." I thought you were talking about the entomologist Jackie Chan. I was really confused there.
Shut up.
Just to be clear, are we talking about the actor Jackie Chan now?
Oh my.
The Chinese mainlander proponent? The guy who like trying to shit on Taiwan all the time?
That Jackie Chan.
Yeah, that Jackie Chan. Whenever he's in his films, he's like, I'm fighting one at a time. But in real life, with all of his skills available, if four guys come at me with a 2x4 and like I karate kick one of them,
you're done.
Three other guys are going to hit me over the back of the head with a 2x4. That like there's a reason why like group dynamics. My biggest concern with Shelob is like one or two of these things, hands down. But if she's got a group of like 8 or 10 of these little bastards that are coming in at top speed, it's going to be really hard if they corner you or they get her in any area, even with her webbing around.
Or they start crushing her legs off.
I'm worried that they're going to be able to overwhelm her.
Can she pick them off one by one?
If they separated.
Yeah, I mean, if she's able to set up enough webbing to maybe catch them, I'm just worried. I saw this horrifying video on BBC Earth a couple of years ago, and it's a group of army ants attacking a crab. And they manage to, like, peel back the shell, and then they actually start pushing smaller ants into the inside of the crab to, like, get to work and, like, take this thing down. And I was like, ah, numbers are...
This is something that, you know, it's a trope of horror movies, whereby if you have 8 humans versus 1 person, the reason that they don't take them all on at once is because they're all afraid of dying. But with, you know, like, a colonial species like this, one of them gets taken down... All of them were just piling on top of her at once. So yeah, okay. I think they're going to be able to take you.
I think so too.
And when they go in, there's no coming out. She's always hungry. She always needs to feed.
Anyway, that's it. Come back and join us next week when we touch on whatever, possibly Star Wars, with the last one of the current trilogy coming out.
Sounds good.
All right. Adam, you want to sign us off with the tagline?
Yes. The monsters are not real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye, guys.
Okay, so we have a rare instance this week where Adam and I have to admit that we were wrong about something.
Never.
Which we don't like doing. We do not like doing this. So the koalas aren't actually functionally extinct. Whilst their populations were hit really hard along the east coast, there are still a lot of populations along the southeast coast that are doing fine, including some of those that we talked about that are actually where there's overpopulation issues and that sort of thing.
Exactly.
That doesn't mean that there's no cause for concern here. Those populations themselves, like koalas are incredibly different, like in different populations because there's so little crossover between them because koalas are such picky fuckers. Like we know that they eat the eucalypt trees, but there are different like types of koalas that will only eat like certain types of eucalypt trees, and those eucalypt trees have to all be present in the same area. Like they have completely different gut microbiomes, so the bacteria that lives in your stomach.
Like, and so you can't just relocate koalas either. Like, it's not possible, like we were talking about last week.
They're also ravaged by chlamydia.
Yeah, yeah, chlamydia. And apparently that was potentially spread by cattle.
Really?
I don't know how. Yeah, I don't know how. European cattle, yeah, but...
I think a koala might have been seeing a cow walk by. I think that looks like a little bit of all right.
Mm-hmm, yeah. But anyway, like I said, this is still a huge loss because there's entire unique populations with unique looks, behaviors, gut microbiomes that have been lost. But the species is not in danger of going extinct anytime soon.
No.
So retraction recorded. Yeah. You can read all about it on ecologyforthemasses.com. Adam wrote a really good article with help from Katrin Horweiler, who is a koala biologist at the University of the Sunshine Coast.
Yep.
In every age, there is a cause worth fighting for. But in the future, the greatest threat to our survival will not be man at all.
Kill them all!
Starship Troopers.